If you'll turn over to Revelation chapter 21, we'll start at the end of the book with what I think is a very interesting scripture. Revelation chapter 21 and verse 8. Well, in verse 7 it says, "He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son." And then in verse 8 he says, "But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." And so we have here this very interesting list. But what's interesting to me is if you read it this way, it sounds a little bit odd. What if we drop all the stuff out of the middle and we just say, "But the cowardly shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." All the stuff in the middle, all the other stuff and all the other labels we look at and we go, "Wow, those are pretty bad things." Right? Those murderers and sorcerers and idolaters. That's pretty awful. But the cowardly will be in the lake of fire. It's a curious call out that those who are cowardly are going to end up with murderers and sorcerers and liars and sexually immoral. Why the cowardly? Why is it that the cowardly end up in there? Let's turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 1. Because there's a fairly simple explanation, I think, for it. It says the cowardly. That word cowardly is delos. Cowardly and delos will be in the lake of fire. And here in 2 Timothy chapter 1, in verse 7, we see that God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and of a sound mind. Fear there is a word that's related to delos. It's deleia or something like that. I don't speak the Greek. But it's a related word. It's the same idea. It's the same principle. He says that God has not given us a spirit of fear. He hasn't given us a cowardly spirit. He's given us a different spirit. He's given us a spirit that is of power and love and a sound mind. And so the very simple explanation for why the cowardly end up in the lake of fire is because cowardliness is incompatible with God's spirit. That's essentially what Timothy is telling us here. That cowardliness and God's spirit can't overlap. They don't work together. They compete. And so it's this cowardliness, this fear, that I want to talk about today. If we're characterized by fear, we're going to find ourselves in the lake of fire. Obviously, that's not where any of us wants to end up. But that's what it says here, is that the cowardly are there. A couple of times, Jesus Christ called out his disciples, and we'll go into these examples in a little more detail, but he called out his disciples, he said, "Why are you so fearful, O you of little faith?" He said, "Why are you so fearful?" Because fear and faith are inversely correlated. The more fear you have, the less faith it is likely that you have. The more faith you have, right, the less fear you're going to have. And so we ought to not be characterized by fear, but by something else, by courage. And so it's courage that we want to talk about today. We want to talk about being strong and of good courage, to pull a phrase from Joshua. We ought to be characterized by courage. Now you might sort of think to yourself, "Well, I'm not characterized by fear. I'm not really a fearful person. I don't walk around, I'm timid all day long." I think what's more common in our society, perhaps, especially, is sort of something on that spectrum of fear that we call discouragement. We get easily discouraged. Right? We lose courage. And as we get discouraged, we tend more toward that state of fear or cowardliness that is called out in Revelation 21. Discouragement is sort of that slippery slope toward fear, toward outright fear. Courage, then, is really essential to us every day. Courage is something that, again, it's going to combat the discouragement, even. We have to have courage. So today I want to look at some examples and draw out a few things about courage. I've got 3 points for you, but we'll look at some stories today. I told the kids on the way over here, I said, I'm going to tell some really good stories today. They're all right out of our Bible. And the stories, as you go in and you study courage, and you look at these examples of courage, because the Bible is full of examples of people who were courageous. And as you go and you look at these examples, you start seeing certain things come out. And so I want to talk about 3 of those things in particular. As you study it, you might find other things. But these are the big 3 things that sort of jumped out as I was looking at all these stories and looking through the examples that we see here. So I want to go through 3 things today about courage. Number 1, courage is focused on what is right. Courage is focused on what is right. Usually, courage is focused on what is right without any regard, or sometimes with an intentional disregard for your own personal well-being. Right? We can easily think about this in a military context, right? The people who are courageous are the ones who are going out there and charging, and they're not caring, they don't care about their bodies or their safety. They're doing what's right. They're going to go do what's right and disregard their own personal consequences. But it doesn't, that's not the state most of us find ourselves in. We're not charging out into battle, not in the physical context. But we also need to be focused on what is right. Discouragement, by contrast, focuses on what is wrong. If we're discouraged because we're focused on what is wrong, on what's not going right, on the things that aren't good, that aren't well. We get discouraged. And then discouragement quickly devolves into fear. Let's go over to Numbers chapter 13. Here's one of our first stories. And this is a story that's hopefully pretty well known. Numbers chapter 13. And this is a very powerful example of what can happen when you focus on what is wrong. And then you get discouraged, and then you devolve into fear. Numbers chapter 13, in verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan." So here they are. Israel has now traveled. They're right on the border of the land of Canaan. They've been out of Egypt for maybe a little over a year at this point. Gone to Mount Sinai. They've received the tablets. They've now traveled up, and they're about to go into Canaan. And he's saying, go send spies. Go look at it. Go check it out. So here they are at the border. "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, everyone a leader among them." And so they pick out 12 men, one from each tribe, leaders of the tribes. And they send them into the promised land. Let's look at verse 21. "So they went up and they spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob, near the entrance of Hamath. And they went up through the south and came to Hebron." Now, when it says they went from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob, it's saying from south to north. The wilderness of Zin is down here at the bottom, and Rehob is up at the north. And it's saying they went through this whole area. It's like 250 miles or so that they covered. They covered all of this. So they would have made this 500-mile round trip. They went through the whole thing and scouted it out. And it says, it especially calls out that they went to Hebron. Now, it's very interesting to think about where they are. They're here on the verge of going into this land that has been promised to their ancestors. Right? This has been a promise, a 400-year-old promise. And here they are. They're on the verge of being able to go in and do it and take the land. And they come to Hebron. Hebron's an interesting place. Let's turn back to Genesis 23. Genesis chapter 23. Genesis 23 and verse 19. This is the account of Sarah's death and burial. So Abraham's wife, Sarah, she died. And it tells a story about Abraham and where he was living. And tells about her burial. And it says in verse 19, it says, "And after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, that is, Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So Hebron is the place that Abraham buried his wife Sarah in a cave. And this tells about the account of him going and buying this cave and acquiring this cave. And if you turn over to chapter 49, we see this mentioned again. We see Jacob talking here. In Genesis chapter 49 and verse 29, he blesses his sons and then he charges them with something. He says, you got to do this. You charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. He's talking about his ancestors. He's talking about his parents and his grandparents. I'm to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. The cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan. Again, that's in Hebron. That's what we just read. He says in verse 31, there they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. So when we see back in Numbers 13, when we see that they came to Hebron, they're coming to a place where their ancestors are buried. This is the graves of their ancestors who originated this whole thing. Right? These are the ones who originally followed God and God promised to them. He made this promise repeatedly over and over to all of them and said, this is the land I'm going to give you. I promise it to you. And here they are coming to their homeland in that sense, coming to the place where their ancestors were buried. I mean, you can imagine if you've ever made a trip going back to a place where you know that certain ancestors were buried, certain grave sites, right? And it's interesting to just think that this is where they lived and this is where my people were. And so this is the land that they're traveling through, and it calls out Hebron. But notice, we're back in Numbers chapter 13 and verse 22. It says, they went through the south and came to Hebron. And does it say they went to the grave and they soaked in the meaning and the significance of this visit? No. It says, Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were there. That's what it calls out about Hebron. It says there were giants there. Later we find they call these the Anakim. They say there were giants there. So they come to this place that has meaning and historical significance, and they're focused on the people of the land and the giants that live in that land. That's what sinks into them. That's where their focus is. They're not focused on what's good and what's right, on the fact that God had promised this land to their ancestors. They're focused on the giants. Let's go down to verse 27. So here the spies come back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation. And in verse 27 it says, we went to the land where you sent us, and it truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. So they brought back a big old bunch of grapes, and they showed it off, and they said, here's the milk and honey, and here's some of its fruit. But you almost get the sense that they're kind of like waving their hands like, yeah, it's a great place, and here's some good food. But, and then they have all these verses that sort of say, but look at all this other stuff. Here's this, and here's this, and here's this, and here's this. And they fill up verse after verse with complaints, with all the things that are wrong, with all the problems. Verse 28. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are very strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Not we saw the graves of our ancestors. Not we understood the promises that were made to us about this land. But we saw the sons of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land in the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. Down to verse 31, the men who'd gone up said, we're not able to go up against the people, for they're stronger than we are. And they gave the children a bad report of the land, which they had spied out. They gave them all the bad stuff. Verse 33, there we saw giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. And so all of this bad news, this bad report, caused a lot of discouragement. We see that in chapter 14. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness, why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us select a leader and return to Egypt." Their discouragement turned into fear, and their fear turned into rebellion, just outright rebellion against God. I mean, this was a mutiny. They said, forget about this Moses guy. Ignore everything that we've done up to this point. You know, they'd seen God on Mount Sinai. They'd received the Ten Commandments. They'd seen all the miracles along the way. They'd seen so much. And here they're ready to write it all off and just return back to Egypt because they got so discouraged by the report that was given. Because they were focused on what was wrong. They were focused on the problems. Courage, by contrast, is focused on what is right. And we see this when we look at the report from Joshua and from Caleb. We skipped over that. If we go back to verse 30 in chapter 13, we see Caleb is focused on what is right. He's not focused on the problems, on the issues. He's focused on what is right. Verse 30, Caleb quieted the people before Moses, and he said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." He understood that God had promised this land to them. And here's what's right. Here's what God wants us to do. We're well able to overcome. He knew it. If you look a little further down, we see Joshua, the son of Nun, chapter 14, in verse 6. Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, they tore their clothes and they spoke to the congregation. And they said, "The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land." He's focused on what is good, on what is right. And beyond that, "If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us to this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land." He says, don't worry about the bad stuff. "For they are our bread." He says, we're going to eat them up. That's the implication. We're going to devour them. "They are our bread. The protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." So again, these were focused on what was right. And they didn't have, obviously, they knew there were some challenges, but they said, God's departed from them, and it's our job to go in and do this. And so they had courage. We see a similar example if we go over to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 17 and verse 26. Again, because courage is focused on what is right, right? Not on the problems or the challenges. It's focused on what is correct here. What does God want here? What's the right thing here? 1 Samuel chapter 17. Let's look in verse 23. Here David comes to his brothers in the army, and he's talking with them, and as he's talking with his brothers, verse 23, as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming from the armies of the Philistines, and so he spoke according to the same words. And David heard the things that he was saying. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, they fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. Let's drop down to verse 26. Then David spoke to the men who stood by him and said, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Here he's focused on what's right. He says, this guy is coming out here and he's blaspheming our God. He's making fun of him. He's saying all this terrible stuff. So So David, it's interesting here because it's almost like he's just already anticipating the win. He's saying, okay, what's going to be done for the person who takes care of this? Because this isn't right and it needs to be stopped. So what's going to happen when I beat this guy? Right? And he knew it wasn't because of him. He knew it was because God was going to not let his name be blasphemed in that way. David was focused on what was right, on what needed to happen. And so in the face of that, he had courage. He had strength. Let's look at another story, the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 3 and verse 15. This is one of the great stories of the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar builds a statue, tells everybody that they need to bow down in front of it. And we've got these three guys that are there that refuse to do it. And so Nebuchadnezzar's full of rage and wrath and anger. He's going to throw him in the furnace. And he kind of lays it out for him and says, here's what's going to happen. But notice Daniel 3 and verse 15. It says, if you're ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn and the the flute and the harp and the lyre, fall down and worship the image which I have made. Good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? So again, he's one of those that's there ready to make fun of God, ready to put God down. Nebuchadnezzar knew that he had come in and been able to conquer this area where this God of Israel was. So his gods must be stronger than this God. So he's saying, who's going to save you? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. They tell him outright. They knew what was right. They were focused on what was right. They were going to do what was right. And so they had courage because they knew whatever the outcome, you see looking at it, they didn't know the outcome. They didn't know whether it was going to be good or whether it was going to end in their death. But they knew that whatever the outcome, they were going to be doing what was right and God was going to back them. And so he says, let it be in verse 18, they say, if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods. Nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. He said, here's what's right, so here's what we're going to do. And they trusted that God would have their backs. Let's go look at a New Testament example, Acts chapter 4 and verse 19. So here, it's early in the history of the church, and the Jews really don't like these guys out there preaching about Jesus. Because they knew they'd killed him. They were trying to quiet the people and get all this settled down. And so here in Acts chapter 4, verse 19, Peter and John answered because they were told, they said, don't go out there and preach anymore. You're not allowed to do this. And this was by the ruling council who had power to do a lot of terrible things to them. So they said, don't go out there and preach this anymore. And notice their response. Peter and John answered and said to them, whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you more than God, you judge. For we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. Again, they were focused on what was right. They were focused on what ought to be, not the problems. Right? Not what was wrong, not the challenges. Oh no, we're going to get beaten and thrown in jail and have all these terrible things. They were focused on what was right. And that gave them the courage to go and to do. Having courage to look past what is wrong and pursue what is right. That's what we're asked to do every day as Christians, is to be able to look past what's wrong with our situation, whatever our challenges are. Be able to look past that, to look toward what is right, and to pursue what is right. I'll read you Joshua 23, toward the end of Joshua's life. Joshua 23, verse 6. Therefore be very courageous, to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses. Notice, it required courage to obey the commandment. Joshua's saying, you have to be courageous to follow God's law, lest you turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left, lest you go among the nations, these who remain among you. For us to go out and follow God's instructions, to be obedient every day, to not turn to the left or to the right every day, requires courage. It says, be courageous to go do that. So we need to have the courage to see what's right and look past what's wrong. That's point number one. Point number two. Courage requires a belief in something bigger, something outside of yourself. Most stories of courage demonstrate an individual's belief in something bigger, something outside of self. Something larger, whether maybe it's a team or a family, right, or their military unit, or in God himself. You hear these stories of courage, both in the Bible and out of the Bible. And generally, the people who are demonstrating that courage believe in something bigger, something beyond yourself. Discouragement is the opposite. Right? Discouragement drives us to think about ourselves to the exclusion of everybody else. When we get discouraged, right, when we start focusing on all the things that are wrong, right, it drives us to think about ourselves. Right? We turn inward, we sort of focus in, kind of turn away, just sort of hunker down. And that's discouragement. And it's easy to get discouraged when you start thinking about yourself because you realize how little power you actually have to really do anything, right? To really affect a lot of change. Individually, it's just on our own, we really don't. We don't have a lot of power to do much of anything. And so we get further discouraged because we turn in. We go, I just can't do this. I just can't do this. And it's a lot of the times it's true. I just can't do this. But we're not called to just be alone and to be ourselves. Let's look at another story. Let's go over to 1 Kings chapter 19. There are some stories of people getting discouraged. Verse 1. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. So Elijah just has this great thing happen for him at Mount Carmel, and God answers him and proves that the pagan gods are a sham, and they execute all of the pagan priests. And so here's this great thing that God has done in the sight of all of Israel. Ahab goes and tells Jezebel about it. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." And when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life. And he went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. So here he gets discouraged. We don't know entirely why. It's possible that he saw this big thing happen, and he thought something was going to change. He thought there was going to be this big change through Israel. He maybe just wasn't expecting a death threat in the face of that. It's possible that he lost sight of God, that he lost sight of what God was doing, of God's power. And then he realized, hold on, if she wants to get me, I'm powerless to stop her. Because Elijah probably was powerless to stop her. But he lost sight of God. He became maybe a little bit too focused on his own self and his own state, and we'll see some evidence of that here in a little bit. He went to Beersheba, which is in the south of Israel, and he left his servant there. But he left from there, which was kind of at the very southern end of Israel. He flees and gets about as far away as you can. He leaves a servant there, and then he goes another day's journey into the wilderness. And he came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die, and said, "It is enough Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's. He's very much focused on himself, on his own state, on where he wants to be. He says, I just take my life, God. I'm no better than my father's. Let's go down to verse 13. Verse 13. In the verses between there, you can go back and read it. But in the verses between there, God's very, very gentle with Elijah. He gives him food, and he actually brings him down to Mount Horeb, which is Mount Sinai. So here Elijah flees even further south, and he goes to Mount Sinai. And here he finds a cave, and he spends the night in a cave at Mount Sinai. It's interesting that Expositor's Bible Commentary points out that in the Hebrew, it says he came to the cave. And so there's some speculation that this could be the same cave that God put Moses in when he showed himself to Moses. It's speculative, but he's definitely here at Mount Sinai. He's here at a holy place, and at a place of meaning and significance. And in verse 13, we see God's going to help Elijah here see outside of himself. Because Elijah has just been focused in on himself and focused in on himself. 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse 13. So it was when Elijah heard this voice, this still small voice, he wrapped his face in his mantle and he went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. Suddenly a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He says, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." This is the third time God has asked him this, and this is the third time he's given this answer, where God says, "What are you doing here?" And he says, It's just me now. It's just me. And he's very focused on himself, but God is helping him see a little bit beyond that. God takes him to this place and shows him his power. He shows him the wind, and he shows him the earthquake, and he shows him a big fire. He demonstrates power and helps Elijah sort of see a little bit outside of himself, to see beyond just what he's going through, to remember that he has a God that's a very powerful God and a very great God. And then in verse 15, God says to him, you notice he doesn't directly address the things that Elijah is complaining about here. He's very gentle with him. He says, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria. And anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, you shall anoint as prophet in your place." And he says in verse 18, "I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." So he points out, he says, "No, look, you're not the only one. I've got 7,000 people in all of Israel. There are others who are following me too." He's getting him to think outside, to focus outside. He's getting a bigger picture and reminding him, no, there's something bigger you can trust in here. You don't just need to be focused on yourself. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 8. There's another example. Matthew chapter 8 and verse 23. Because we see here the same kind of thing where people, they forget about God. We get in these situations where we have challenges and we forget how powerful our God is. And we forget that there's something outside of us. We get focused on the things that are about to hurt us or do damage or whatever it is. And we get worried about our own things and our own situation. We turn inward and we focus on ourselves. But God's there to remind us, no, there's something bigger. Matthew chapter 8, verse 23. "And when he got into a boat, his disciples followed him. And suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea so that the boat was covered with the waves. But he was asleep." Jesus Christ is asleep in the boat. "Then his disciples came to him and awoke him and said, 'Lord, save us, we are perishing.'" And we can get into these similar situations where we are fearful. We say, "Oh no, Look at what I'm going through. Lord, save us, we're perishing. It's interesting that it says that they were fearful. Jesus Christ says to them, but he said to them, verse 26, why are you fearful? This word fearful is the same word cowardly that we read in Revelation 21. It's the same word. He said, why do you have this fear? Why are you being cowardly? Oh, you of little faith. It's interesting that he correlates fear with faith. He says, you don't have a lot of faith, and that's why you have all of this fear. If there were faith, there wouldn't be this fear. Because they didn't understand. It's interesting, they came to him and they said, save us. We are perishing. They understood that there was probably something he could do. That he might be able to do something. But they didn't necessarily have full faith in what he was going to do, because when we see that he calms the wind and the waves, they say, who is this? We didn't know he could do that. Who is this that could do that? But they believed he could do something. But they didn't see beyond themselves. They didn't have the faith to realize that it wasn't just them on the ship. It was the Son of God who was on the ship. And the Son of God isn't going to die in a storm on a boat in the middle of a lake. They lacked faith. They lacked sort of that big picture understanding to see that this isn't how the Son of God was going to die. And they were there with him. And they would learn that wasn't going to be how he met his end. And that certainly wasn't how they were going to meet their end. They had a bigger purpose here. And Jesus Christ says, oh, you of little faith. He understood, no, there's a bigger picture. There's a longer term thing going on here. He had called them to do something. He hadn't called them to come die on a boat. They lacked the faith in that. Expositor's Bible commentary says, what is clear is that both Mark and Matthew in this account, they set faith over against fear. Faith chases out fear, or fear chases out faith. One's going to chase the other one off, drive the other one off. So it's very hard to consider or have courage to consider another one and to consider others, right? When our discouragement has focused us in on ourselves, right? Our courage will focus us out on something bigger. Let's look at some of those those big picture views. Deuteronomy chapter 20. Deuteronomy chapter 20. And verse 1. Deuteronomy 20 and verse 1. When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them. And notice he says, here's why. Here's why you shouldn't be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. He says, think bigger. Think outside of the problems right in front of you. Think outside of yourselves and your own power. Just think about the fact that the God that brought your ancestors out of the land of Egypt, right? He's the one that's with you. The God that overthrew the Egyptians, that sent all the plagues, that parted the seas, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. He's the one that's with you to help you. In verse 2, so it shall be when you are on the verge of a battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people. And he shall say to them, hear, O Israel, today you are on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart faint. Do not be afraid and do not tremble or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you. So he tells them, you have to get this big picture view. Remember, God is on your side. This isn't just you going out to fight a battle. This isn't just this army going out to fight a battle. God is with you. Let's look at an individual example of this. 1 Samuel chapter 14. This is another great story. 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verse 6. Because I think Jonathan understood that principle. He understood the idea that was presented there in Deuteronomy 20. He got the picture that it wasn't just him going out to do this. And he states it here. 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verse 6. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come and let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised." So Israel is in a war with the Philistines. And Jonathan and his armor bearer have sort of, they've wandered off from camp, just the two of them. They've wandered off from camp. Jonathan says, let's go over to this garrison over here. He knew where it was. "Let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few." Remember in Deuteronomy 20, the priest goes out and says, it's the Lord who saves you. He's there to save you. And Jonathan here says, nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. So his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Go then, I am here with you, according to your heart." Jonathan said, "Very well, let us cross over to these men. We'll show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, 'Wait until we have come to you,' then we'll stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us." So both of them showed themselves to the Philistines. And they said, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of their holes where they have hidden." Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come up to us and we'll show you something." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel." And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. So Jonathan and his armor bearer against 20 guys. And because of God, which he recognized, he knew, because of God, he was able to overcome all of them. And this was the beginning of a great rout by the Israelites. This was the start of something where they then went on to rout the Philistines and had a big victory over them. Jonathan knew that it wasn't his might or his power. He knew that it was God. He saw outside of himself and his own strength, and he knew God can do whatever he needs to do here. And he had the courage to act on it. Let's go over to John 16:33. John 16:33. We were there during the sermonette also. John 16:33. Jesus Christ says, "These things I've spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation." Notice the next phrase here. He says, "But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." That phrase where he says, "be of good cheer," is in other translations, it's rendered, "be courageous." It's a word that encourages, it's not just, "oh, just be cheerful, be happy." He's saying, "be courageous, take heart. Don't be afraid, because he has overcome the world." It's interesting, in other verses, we see this same word used. When Jesus walked on the water to his disciples, and his disciples thought he was a ghost, it says they were very afraid of him. They thought he was a ghost, and they were terrified. And Jesus' response to them is, "be of good cheer," which in English doesn't really quite make sense to us. You go, well, that's kind of an odd greeting. He's not saying, "oh, just be happy." He's saying, "be courageous. Don't be afraid. It's me." And he encouraged them. The story of, in the book of Luke, we won't turn over there in the book of Luke, though. The woman who came up and touched Jesus Christ, she had the flow of blood, and she came and she touched him, and she was healed. Jesus Christ turns around and he says, "somebody touched me. What happened?" And she was terrified. It says in Luke that she was afraid, that she was trembling. She knew that she had been found out, and she thought she was going to be in trouble. And so she came before him, and she's trembling with fear. And she says, "it was me." And he says, "be of good cheer." Except that's not quite the feel, right? He says, "don't be afraid. Don't be afraid." He's encouraging. He says, be courageous. So Jesus in John 16, he tells us, be courageous because he has overcome the world. He's telling us that we can have courage, not because we are anything, but because he is in us and he is for us and he is with us. And he's overcome everything. He's conquered everything. And he's with us. We have his power in us. And he says, remember that. Remember that and have courage. Because he has overcome the world. Let's go over to Matthew 28, verse 28. Or Matthew 28, verse 20. Sorry, there is no 28. Matthew 28, verse 20. Here at the end of the Great Commission, it says, teach them to observe all things that I command you. And lo, I am with you some of the time. Right? It doesn't say, I'm with you when you need me. Or, he doesn't even say, I'm with you when you want me around. He says, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. Right, he doesn't say, well, maybe I'll be there for you. Right, he's called us and he has promised to be with us. And that's what he wants us to focus on, right? That's why he says, be courageous, because he is with us. We're told in Ephesians to be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. That's his might, right? Not our might. So again, point number two is simply that courage requires faith, belief, and trust in something bigger. Point number three, courage demands action. Courage demands action. Courage is not stagnant, and it's not the thing that takes the path of least resistance. Courage demands action. It demands that we go and do. Discouragement, by contrast, immobilizes us. Right? We get discouraged and we just sort of hunker down. We go, I can't do anything here. And we get up and watch Netflix all day and we go to sleep. Right? Discouragement will do that to us. You know, sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and I lack the drive to do much of anything because I get discouraged. Right? I think we all have those days. We're discouraged about something and we lack the motivation to go and act, to go and do something, to go and do anything, because discouragement immobilizes us. That was Elijah. Elijah was just kind of like, I've got nothing, it'd be better for me to die. And that was it. If you think about the parable of the talents, right? The guy who was given the one talent, he didn't do anything with that talent. He just buried it and kind of did nothing, right? He didn't act because he was afraid. He had fear. He was discouraged, and so he just did nothing. But those who have courage will go and act. Courage demands action. Let's go over to Daniel 6. We'll look at a couple more stories here as we wind down. Daniel chapter 6 and verse 6. So here's this big plot against Daniel. These governors and all these people that hate Daniel, they come to the king. Daniel 6:6. They come to the king and say to him, King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators, the satraps, the counselors, the advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. And so he signs this decree. He says, okay, here's what's going on. And then Daniel was just immobilized with fear and did nothing. Right, that's not the story. Verse 10. Let's read Daniel 6 and verse 10. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. It's like he made it a point. Some of the commentators speculate that he went home and he opened the windows up and he made a public example of it so that other Jews other captives among them would know that, no, this is still what we do. And he went home and he acted. It's almost like he was flagrantly violating this law, because he had the courage to do what was right. And he knew that God would have his back. He understood that. He went and acted. Courage demands that kind of action. It demands that we go and that we do. Let's go over to the book of Ezra. There's a great story in the book of Ezra. Similar kind of thing, where we see people in a situation that demands action. Ezra chapter 8 and verse 21. So here we find Ezra is in Babylon, and he's got a group of people, and they're all going to travel back to Jerusalem. Captives have been granted a safe passage back to Jerusalem. Well, they've been granted permission to travel back to Jerusalem. The king has given them permission to go back and rebuild and start building up the city again. And so he has a bunch of people with him, a bunch of little ones, even families. They're all going to travel along. In verse 21, he says, "Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from him the right way for us and our little ones and all our possessions. For I was ashamed to request of the king an escort of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy on the road, because we had spoken to the king, saying, 'The hand of our God is upon all those for good who seek him. But his power and his wrath are against all those who forsake him.' So we fasted and entreated our God for this, and he answered our prayer." Notice he understood what was right, and he had faith in God, that God would protect them, that God would keep them safe as they traveled. It's very likely, Barnes Notes makes the comment, that their trip from Babylon over to Jerusalem was about 900 miles. It was 900 miles. Right? And this wasn't an army that was moving, that was trained and skilled, that could make a quick trip. This was 900 miles with little ones, with whatever animals and stuff they had to take. It was going to be a long, slow trip. And it was a very perilous trip. It would be common to have raiders that would come and take and murder. And you know, they weren't a huge band, and they weren't armed. And so here he's having to put his faith on the line and say, "Well, I told the king that God will protect those who trust in him." And now he has to go and act on that. They have to go make this 900-mile journey after making the statement that, well, God protects his people. He had to actually go do it. He had to follow through. And so they fasted and they prayed, and then they went. They acted. We see this in multiple stories. You can go back and look through all of these stories where we see people who have courage, and that courage and their faith demand that they act, that they go do something. And so it is for us, so we have to act. Sometimes that action is waiting. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but sometimes that action is waiting. Psalm 27, verse 14. Psalms chapter 27 and verse 14 says this: "Wait on the Lord, be of good courage." Those two things are coupled there. He says, be of good courage and wait. Wait on the Lord. Now, this isn't a kind of waiting that is just sort of inaction or just sit around, just hunker down and, you know, watch Netflix all day. That's not the waiting that he's talking about. It's a waiting with a sense of expectation and hope. It's continuing to live your life in a way that is pleasing to God. If you think about Abraham and Sarah, when God gave them the promise and said, "I'm going to make you a great nation. Go out." And they go. Abraham was 75 years old. And it wasn't for 25 years before Isaac was born. They waited 25 years for a son. They were old when they were sent out. And then they waited another 25 years and had to trust that God was going to follow through on his promise. And we see that the way that Abraham lived his life over the course of 25 years, yeah, he had a couple of low spots in there, but the way that Abraham lived his life over the 25 years was one of obedience, was one of expectation. He was waiting on God and trusting in God and living his life day to day in obedience to God. That's the kind of waiting that we're called on to do sometimes. And it requires courage. It demands daily action. It demands focus. So we have to have that kind of diligence sometimes to be courageous enough to wait on God and to see what he will do. So our three points then. We have to focus on what is right. Courage focuses on what is right. Courage recognizes that there is something bigger, that we're not alone. Courage demands action. And I think if you think about the kinds of things that you say to people when you are trying to encourage them. Right? You'll say, "Things are going to be all right. Right? This is all going to work out." Right? Or that one that we love hearing, "Think about all the character you're building." But it focuses on what is right. Right? It focuses on what's good. Right? That's the one thing. Sometimes we'll say things like, "God knows what you need." Right? "God knows what he's doing. God's still in control." Right? We get people to focus outside of themselves, to remember that God is involved. Or we say, "We're all here. We're all pulling for you." Right? There are others. Right? We get them to focus outside of themselves and focus on this big thing that God has called us to be a part of. Other times when you're encouraging them, you say, "You can do this. Go get them." We've had our kids in swim practice and on swim team this year. And there are times we've had to tell them, "Look, you can do this. Go act. You have to go do. You have to act on this. Be courageous." One final scripture. I'll just read it to you. Psalm 31, verse 23. "O love the Lord, all you his saints, for the Lord preserves the faithful." Preserves the faithful, those who trust in him, who see outside themselves, who look at him, and fully repays the proud person. "Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart, all you who hope in the Lord."